and please state your name and indicate what party you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. And when you're ready, you may go ahead.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Jace Junker, in this matter. I don't know if this can be qualified as a case of first impression or if it's actually governed by well-established case law. Mr. Junker should prevail under either theory. In terms of being a case of first impression, I could not find any case law where a district court judge found that a driver had actually burped during the observation period.
It seems like Hounsell may come the closest, but I don't think there was a finding in that case that the driver actually burped. He just claimed.
Correct. And there's multiple cases where the claim was made. And this court, in my opinion, correctly found over and over again, like, that's a credibility determination for the district court to make.
The judge in this case did find that he burped.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's why I say it may be a case of first impression, where we've actually got a judge that said, this isn't mere speculation. You're not merely claiming that a burp happened during the observation period. I'm finding that that happened. In terms of following well-established case law, that seems to be the burden.
Can I just ask, Mr. Kohler, I'm curious here. I'm assuming, if I recall from the record, the petitioner himself didn't recall. I was asked that question. The deputy didn't recall seeing it, or the trooper as it was. So how did the judge come to that? Do you know, or just a matter of a fact, was it viewing the video and then observing it and hearing it?
I believe it was a mix of viewing the video and listening to Mr. Junker's testimony. He was sweating bullets on the stand. He's a very good-hearted individual, but not particularly sophisticated. He's a logger by trade. And he was very nervous on the stand. But the testimony that came out, the officer thought that he had asked Mr. Junker, you know, did you burp? But review of the video shows that that wasn't actually true. Like, that question was never asked. He asked, did you vomit? And the question, did you burp, was never asked.
But, you know, I'd like to address this issue regarding the admissibility of the breath test. The state had the burden of making out a prima facie case of test reliability in order to admit the test. And when in this proceeding, the implied consent hearing, the commissioner offered the test exhibit, the attorney, who wasn't you, said at the... Was it you?
It was
me.
Yes,
it was you. You said, Your Honor, without waiving the ultimate issue, I have no objection. And then the court admitted the test result. Is that a waiver as to challenging the admissibility? Or it's difficult to know what was meant there without waiving the ultimate issue.
I absolutely hope I wasn't waiving my client's issue. I think that would border on malpractice. That was a pro forma objection because the issue we were challenging was either the admissibility or the reliability of the test. And the case law is unclear on that, too.
Okay, I should have included your entire quote. You said, Your Honor, without waiving the ultimate issue, I have no objection. And so I just was a little confused about that.
Yeah, and that was for the purposes of allowing the judge to have the test record itself to look at, like, during briefing and as the case was going forward.
But the ultimate objection was the admissibility? I mean, you're arguing in your brief that the test results, I think you're arguing, should not have been admissible.
The argument is twofold. The core argument is for rescission, and as the case law doesn't make it perfectly clear where these types of challenges come into play. The McGregor case, where the officer didn't know anything about the observation period. The court said, you know, you don't even meet your prima facie case at this point. So we're throwing it on that ground. That would say it's an admissibility argument. The standard in bond, the burden shifting, says once you make this minimal prima facie case, which has nothing to do with the observation period, basically just a certified operator, the burden of production then shifted to me in this case to bring up forth something that was more than speculation. So the test result was technically admitted, and then the burden of production shifted to me to show that with more than speculation, something went wrong with the observation period. We did that. We proved the burp, which should have then shifted the burden of proof and production back to the state.
Well, I guess that's what really confuses me about the case, whether or not the test results should have been admitted when you have this alleged flaw that occurred because of the burping during the observation period, which the district court found to have occurred. And then there was no restarting of the observation period. I mean, it seems to me it's a big deal in this case because of the burden shifting.
Before you answer Judge Shellhouse's question, can you answer it by explaining to me what the slope detector thing is as a part of the DMT?
The slope detector.
And I want you to answer her question, but I think that's a part of it, that the slope, as I understand it, I'll let you explain, but isn't that supposed to offer some adequate protection?
It's supposed to offer some protection. If somebody burps as they're blowing, the slope detector is there to make sure. I mean, the details of the slope detector didn't get into this record. It takes quarter-second measurements.
But think about it. If they have not established a prima facie case because there's a determination of burping, so then you have the machine that's supposed to do something, if somebody burps or it's supposed to show a reading, would that render the test then invalid?
I'm afraid I don't fully understand the question, and I'll try to answer it, and if I'm completely off base.
How about you answer Judge Shellhouse's question, because I was keying in on that.
Yeah, and when it comes to that, to the judge's question, I mean, it does depend on whether it was conditionally admitted, like after the fact, the judge determined that the prima facie case wasn't made. Like, I suppose the judge didn't use the phrase conditionally admitted, but I guess that was what I was going for when I said, you know, without waiving our ultimate challenge to this test result, otherwise there's no need for a hearing. You can look at this test record because there was still more evidence to be presented to the court at that time, specifically regarding the burp. The one thing that wasn't fully anticipated was what the court was looking for in terms of how a burp affects a test result. In relying on cases that dealt with non-alcohol, like chewing tobacco, chewing gum, and smoking. I mean, in this case, the whole reason for this observation period and burping is to prevent the introduction of mouth alcohol. And there was evidence in the record that that's what the observation period is for.
The basis for the commissioner's revocation is because the DMT reported a result and it didn't flag anything as invalid. Right.
Correct. The machine didn't flag anything as invalid. And
what you're challenging is then the integrity of the machine, because it flies in the face of not only your client testifying that he burped, but the judge reflecting on the video that he did burp, but nothing happened then to interrupt the machine.
In addition, the testimony of the officers that they're supposed to restart the observation period whenever somebody burps, because otherwise the result, you can't treat it as valid and reliable. And that is the same language that's been in the case law.
It's not disputed. There was no restarting of the test. That was a supervisor's testimony, right?
Correct. Correct. And even the first officer, the one that was in training, was admitted that, well, maybe not restart, but I would need to investigate further to see if the burp brought up any alcohol. I'm not sure how that works, but it would be impossible.
Mr. Kohler, just to get back then to the admissibility versus credibility, was the petition clear, you believe, to the commissioner what the issue was, which is that this is an inaccurate test result, which should lead to a rescission? And so what you're saying now is if you'd have been a little more artful with your objection, you would have said, I conditionally do not object to the test, but that is the very issue in question, and your position then being the prima facie basis of its credibility has not been established, so the judge could have done one of two things, which either of which would have led to a rescission. Either one, simply in its order, the court agrees and did not consider the test, or number two, agrees and found the test not convincing because of that, hence either way a rescission occurs.
Better stated than I did, but that was the, once the phrase conditional admission popped into my head, I seized on it because that was the intention in allowing the test result to be given to the judge. And that's why, rather than just saying no objection, I think they've met their prima facie case, I said, you know, just preserving the right that, you know, I'm challenging either. And again, the case law says it both ways. Sometimes deficiencies in the observation period can undermine the prima facie case. Other times, the prima facie case for admissibility is met, and then we're into the whole burden shifting, where yes, the test result is admissible, but petitioners still have this opportunity to bring forth evidence challenging the test in light of the prima facie admissibility. And as Your Honor said, in under either scenario, I'm asking for rescission. It's just two different paths of getting to the same result. And the case law does go both ways. Like I think McGregor and the Kramer case both treated it as, you know, respondent can't make their prima facie case if there's a legitimate deficiency found in the observation period. Most of the other cases say it's admissible, and then after admissibility, we're looking at the reliability and the weight of the test. And all of those cases seem to at least strongly imply, if not outright say, that, you know, that the burden at that point is for the driver to show that he actually burped, which ends up being a credibility determination for the district court judges to make based on whatever evidence is presented. The petitioner testifying, law enforcement witnesses testifying, video can potentially be a godsend in cases like this because it's objective. And you can weigh the objective evidence against the testimony of the two opposing witnesses. But that's how I think this court should rule, is just that it is more than speculation when a district court finds, yes, this petitioner burped. And when a petitioner burps, whether it was detected or not, and the observation period wasn't restarted, that test result can't be used to support a revocation. And that's the whole reason for the observation period, is that it's impossible to later go back and say, yeah, he burped, but did the burp elevate the test results? Because we don't know. The safeguards that are in place, software side on the machine, the slope detector and testing the two tests as 0.02 of one another, that's absolutely insufficient for for ruling out mouth alcohol. If they were sufficient, there'd be no need for an observation period. I know the BCA doesn't want officers sitting there twiddling their thumbs for 15 minutes, and it's hard-coded into this instrument. Unlike previous instruments, the officer needs to type in, I'm starting the observation period, and then the machine will not permit a breath test for 15 minutes. I mean, it's very important, and it's a core component of officers' training. It's about a quarter to a fifth of their overall certification training is how to conduct a proper observation period, because nothing is better at ruling out mouth alcohol than that 15-minute deprivation period. And I don't think that this is going to cause any incredible troubles for the district courts, for this court to rule that, yes, this case needs to be rescinded because the driver burped, because that's exactly how things are operating in the district courts right now. Is that if a driver says something was wrong with the observation period, the court says, all right, show me why. And if the driver says, well, I don't know if I burped or not, but he wasn't watching me, the case law makes it clear that's not enough. If the driver says, I burped, I know I burped, and the district court says, I don't believe you, that's not credible, the courts have said that's not enough. It's when the district court says, yeah, you burped multiple times. We absolutely can't rule out mouth alcohol in this case. That puts the burden on respondent to try to prove that the burp didn't affect the test results, because they are the proponent of this scientific evidence. And just like it's impossible to prove that it did, honestly, it's also impossible to prove that it didn't. And in that circumstance, I think that just rescission as a matter of law is appropriate once that credibility determination has been made. I'll save the rest of my argument for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leah Hedman. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety. Yes, this case is about shifting burdens. That's really where we're at. And I think, Your Honor, Judge Shellhouse, you put the absolute nail on it. And that's why I would present the second page of the transcript where Mr. Noller says the only issue raised by the petitioner is the validity, reliability, and the, page three, accuracy of the breath test. Nothing about the admissibility of the breath test, that prima facie case. So let's just run through the well-established case law in this area, and it truly is really from 1984. I mean, it goes back very, very long in our history. The shifting burden, the commissioner has the initial burden of proof to make a prima facie showing of reliability, and that's also in statute. Minnesota Statute 634.16 also is a specific evidentiary statute for admissibility of breath tests. And under the Zurn case of this court, as well as more recently the Vondracek case, the prima facie showing that the commissioner must bear for its burden of proof is that a certified operator performed the test and that the breath testing machine performed its diagnostic checks indicating that it was in proper working order. That is the threshold test for admissibility. It's that base level prima facie case. Here, the commissioner clearly did meet that burden. Once that's established, then the burden of production shifts to the driver to show two things, that something happened and that it actually affected the test.
Okay, let me ask you this. When we look at the Supreme Court's decision in State versus, I think it's pronounced Dilley,
yep.
I don't know, 1977 case, the Supreme Court said, we agree that the prosecution has the burden to prove that contaminants have not adversely affected the reliability of the test. And so when you just said the only two things that you need to prove in order to have the test result admitted is that you have a certified operator and that the test, the machine was working properly, okay?
Yes.
But what if you have evidence that somebody has burped or regurgitated or belched during the 15-minute period? That affects the reliability of the testing, doesn't it?
Well, let's talk. It may, but it may not.
And
it's their burden.
Burden.
It's clearly the burden of production for the driver to produce evidence that indicates that, yes, I burped, and not only did I burp, but it actually had an effect in the test. But
how
let me
could any, just I got, I just have to ask you.
No, of course.
I mean, what you're saying makes sense. The from a practical perspective, however, here we have burping. In another case, maybe we have belching. In another case, we have regurgitation. Here we have the court finding that at least two burps occurred. How can a driver ever prove that the contaminants did not adversely affect the test? And what do we do about the language in Dilley in which the Supreme Court said it's the state's burden to prove that contaminants did not adversely affect the test result?
Thanks, Your Honor. I'd like to take that two-part question. I'm going
yes.
to take the second part first. Addressing Dilley, that was a blood test, I believe.
Yes.
So it dealt with the kit and whether or not there were some contaminants contained in the container that the sample was brought into. This is a breath test more similar to the Quinn case, which is also quite old, but a little bit more recent than Dilley, and that deals with breath analysis.
Is that Supreme Court or Court of Appeals?
I believe Supreme. Let me...
And that was a breath test case?
Right. You'll see that I have a number of your cases because there's so many directly on point here.
What
and you're
year
right,
is
there's,
Quinn?
Yep, there's birching, there's burping, there's belching, everything. When you just
but
for
what year is Quinn?
Oh, I'll look. Sorry.
I have mine chronologically ordered.
So Quinn is
If you can't find it, go on, please. You don't have to spend your time.
I think it'll just take me 1 second.
I read it, but don't know if I printed it. I don't remember a case in which a court actually found that a driver burped.
Well, you know, a lot of times they make the claim.
Except this case.
Yeah, a lot of times they make the claim that they did, but then they have nothing to back it up. And I wanted to get to your very...
That's what makes this case so different than all those others, is that we have many drivers who claim they burped, and the courts say, well, that's just speculative. Here, we have an unusual circumstance where the district court found that the driver burped at least twice.
Yeah, so this was on a video, and that the video, he raised his hands up here. There's no actual, like...
Okay, but you haven't challenged the finding.
Nope, and we do not, just so we're clear on this. So the trooper itself who was conducting the observation period and his field training officer, the sergeant that was kind of in and out of the room, both of them did not have any idea with regard to the burping. But the district court found that, and we're not challenging that, absolutely. But it's not really different than any other case, and here's why. Your Honor, Judge Slater, you pointed out that he didn't even know he burped until his petitioner's counsel said it. It's on page 53 of the transcript where the driver himself, Mr. Junker, didn't have any realization that he himself burped.
Yeah,
and
but
he
a
was,
lot of these people are under the influence of alcohol. They don't remember a lot of things about the night.
Well, when you're directly asked a question, and he was a .09, just as the test record that's been admitted indicates, so he's not, you know, extremely beyond intoxication, although clearly over the legal limit. But in this case, he was asked, anything come up from your mouth? And this trooper, who was many years a peace officer, but more recently joined the trooper force, but he said he had been more recently trained from the BCA. And you remember that what was included
but
from them...
But does it even matter if he remembered or not? Because the district court said, you burped.
Right.
I mean, we're beyond all of that.
No, but once we've established that it's the burping, we need to establish whose burden, and that's exactly right. But the burden is to say, I burped, and it affected the breath test this way. This is why. You have that in all of your cases. So if you look at your well-established cases, Shepler, Mellon, Hounsel specifically, it shows that the burden is two parts, and that is, yes, something happened, but that it actually affected the test results. And that is borne by the driver. And that's always been true. So that's been consistent through your case law.
What's the point of the observation period if a driver who burps, belches, or regurgitates during that 15-minute observation period has the burden of proving that there was a contaminant that adversely affected the test result? Because, I mean, and again, I'll ask you, how could a driver ever prove that?
Well, let's talk about that. So in his brief, appellant says we'd have to bring a breath test expert. And clearly that's true. They bring the breath test experts from the BCA all the time, and it's extremely cheap for them to do that because it's controlled by statute. So it's Minnesota Statute 357.22 and Minnesota Statute 634.15. They bring the BCA experts, which go all over the state for people, both criminal and civil cases, defense, and our commissioner, based upon the facts that they are there to give the breath test analysis. What you're going to find is it doesn't help them because mouth alcohol is kind of a misnomer. It's the stomach contents coming up through the mouth. Look on page 10, 9 and 10 of the transcript. It indicates the explanation that that's the concern. It's not actually alcohol within the mouth. It's that stomach contents come up. You have a case which involved actual vomiting, where the person vomited earlier, and they were talking about whether or not that was something that they had they had to show effect of the test, and they said, yes, you have to prove not only that you did vomit, but that you're vomiting, that actually had an effect on the test. So here, that's really a case where you would have mouth alcohol concerns, because that's that stomach contents coming up. With a regular burp, the trooper, Mr. Trooper Anderson, had the most recent training. You'll see that there was some BCA things that we're talking about, the visuals that, you know, sort of they put up on the screen from 3 years ago. But it is not enough to just say, oh, I burped, because burping can sometimes be a very shallow thing that no stomach contents would come up.
Well, I thought that you just suggested that even if stomach contents come up, it doesn't matter.
Well, based on your case law, you had to not just say that you vomited at some point in time, which is what, in that case, I think it's, I'm just going to get
the numbers, did you say?
You know what? It's Nesseth, N-E-S-S-E-T-H, and that's a Court of Appeals case from 1987. The driver failed to show that his earlier vomiting affected the test results. And so,
was earlier vomiting during the observation period?
Your Honor, I can't remember if it's before that or not, but there's only a least, you know, there's only a certain amount of time that they spend with each other. But the key of the observation period here is the trooper did everything according to the book, because he had no idea that he burped in this case. And he was making constant inquiries. He made multiple mouth checks, and he made multiple inquiries. Did anything come up into your mouth? And that's, you know, this is the more recent training that he's received from the BCA.
He had his supervisor testify.
Yep.
That the proper procedure is that if a driver burps, belches, or regurgitates during the 15-minute observation period, you must start the observation period over.
Right.
And we've got his trainee testifying, essentially, it doesn't matter, and we've got you telling us that if you did burp, belch, or regurgitate, there's no need to start the observation period over, and it's the driver's burden of proving that the burp, belch, or vomiting contaminated and adversely affected the result.
Well, let's just clarify that point, if I may. And that is to say that, yes, it is always a good idea to restart a 15-minute observation period, because you eliminate the argument, you don't have a trial, and then the officer doesn't have to come to court. So that's the most prudent course. This is a gentleman that was trained on the intoxilizer. So the sergeant in this case had been on the force for 25-plus years, so he's a lot of experience. Then you have a more recently trained, immediate information from the BCA trooper that had just been trained, but he was on the force for like 5 years before he joined the Minnesota State Patrol. So he's got an FTO, but he has been an officer for a while and trained for a while. So he's giving you good information with regard to mouth alcohol. It is the stomach contents that is the concern. That is true. Is it always a good safeguard to do the additional 15 minutes? Yes, because it eliminates the issue. But the bottom line is 15 minutes, first of all, is a recommendation. It's not a requirement under the BCA protocol. The machine itself is set for 15 minutes. That's what they recommend people do. But again, that's a recommendation. Secondly, in terms of that stomach contents coming up, I wish that we did have BCA testimony in this case. And that's what they really needed, because they said we burped and they said, okay, I can see him going like this on the video. The district court accepted that for purposes of today, we're accepting that he burped. But he has to meet the additional burden to say something about this test record, something about Exhibit 1 shows that there was something off. If you have mouth alcohol, one of your test records, right? So if you burp before you test, that initial test would be higher than your secondary breath test. That makes sense, because mouth alcohol is greater. That's what our concern is, that the stomach is producing an elevated result.
Here, I'm trying to figure out what the BCA expert would say that the trooper and maybe the more recent would say. In other words, what more information we would have as to why we have this 15-minute, and then why, if there's a belt, you start over. And I assume there's a good scientific reason. The experts, maybe even beyond the BCA, who designed these machines and done the testing, wouldn't the answer simply be because it could affect the results? It could affect the results, meaning we aren't sure this result's accurate. Doesn't that essentially get to the same issue of reliability? Therefore, the petitioner the commissioner has not met its burden, it's more likely than not that it was 0.08 or more.
Yeah, really, the established case law does not show that. The established case law says you have to have a certified operator, and they have to the diagnostics have to show that the test is in working order. That gets you to admissibility. That's the prima facie case. Then the burden of production shifts to the defense, to the driver in this case, to show that something happened that actually affected the test.
That's what I'm getting at. Isn't that been met by this testimony and by the burping? Because that's what the expert would say, I'm presuming, and
no. Even if they say a burp happened, it has to actually affect the test. It's not enough to say that, because it could be a burp that's within your own mouth cavity and not affecting stomach contents coming up.
But do you know why they're told to redo it then? Why ever redo it if indeed that's...
Because if you do have mouth alcohol, so if there is stomach contents that come up, then it could be a flag. You'll get an invalid sample because of the slope detector that the Honorable Judge Werke indicated before as well. That's why there's those safeguards within the machine. So if the sample is so out of range, if one is excessively high and low, that's the initial safeguard within that. They have the samples, the slope detector that says if they're receiving a report or if they're receiving data that indicates that there's a spike, that's the slope detector. There's also the 0.2 agreement between the two breath samples. That's why the machine has the two breath samples. And then the third safeguard is the observation period. And here, he's asking him questions. He's looking at him. The observation period cases that you have don't require somebody sitting in front of him watching to see if he burps every 2 seconds. In fact, your cases say you can have him in the back of a squad car. You know, he can go to the restroom with someone. He has a lot of opportunities of freedom. It's quite liberal. So this would be a really significant departure. And what prevents every driver from saying, you know, trying to sneak a burp in or trying to do this to do that with an observation?
Time has expired, but if you'll wrap up. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I wish that you would affirm the district court who correctly applied your well-established case law on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Hedman. Cole, you get the last word.
Thank you, and may it please the court. In terms of whether this is an admissibility challenge or falls under the burden-shifting scheme, if the transcript is read in a way where I waived the initial challenge to the admissibility of the test, as I said, I believe it's two routes to the same result, and the argument's cleaner if it's under the burden-shifting scheme. However, under the burden-shifting scheme, I don't think we do have to prove that it affected the test. And that's perfectly in line with the language in Dilley, where it talks about contaminants. These cases where the requirement was that the driver show that it affected the test was basically telling the driver, prove to the court that these were contaminants. Prove to the court that chewing gum is going to have any bearing whatsoever on infrared spectroscopy in the three spectra that define ethyl alcohol. Same thing with chewing tobacco. Same thing with tobacco smoke. Prove to me that that's a contaminant, and then you've met your burden. And those are all different circumstances than here. This wasn't a penny in the mouth, or he didn't eat onions, and in which case he probably would potentially have to show why that would affect an alcohol test. But here we're talking about the reason for the observation period, and that's burping. And I think under that context, there is no burden. And as the court rightly pointed out, it would be impossible to meet that burden. There's no way to show that it did affect the results. The observation period is very important. And we do a lot of DWI tests with breath alcohol machines in Minnesota on an annual basis. And respondent is correct. I mean, this court has liberally interpreted the observation period. If an officer's not watching somebody like a hawk, that doesn't invalidate the test. What it does is it invites the opportunity for petitioners to challenge that observation period. And the less the officer is watching that driver, the more likely it is something is going to get by. And at the end of the day, it's always going to be the role of the district court to determine, you know, is it credible? Do I believe that this driver burped? And I think ruling in Mr. Junker's favor in this case is not going to turn any case law on its head. It's going to be completely in line with all of the prior cases on this point. And I don't think it's going to be an invitation for a bunch of drivers to perjure themselves in court on the off chance that the judge is going to believe them. This is the first case out of maybe three or four I've raised in 10 years where I legitimately believed my client had burped during the observation period. And this is the first one where the district court said, yep, I believe that. So this is not a particularly common situation, but it is an opportunity to clarify how the standard works when it comes to challenging revocations based on tests with deficient observation periods. And I think the rule of law was and should continue to be after this case that if the driver meets that burden of proving they burped, the revocation should be rescinded. In the criminal context, I believe that's a question for the jury, but we're not, and that also avoids needing to determine if this test is admissible at all or not. The ultimate issue is whether the revocation should be sustained or rescinded. So in another day, I may very well be arguing in this case. We're set for trial in February. I may be trying to argue to the judge that this test result should be inadmissible, but odds are I'm going to end up taking it to the jury, and they're going to be the fact finder that decides. But in the implied consent setting, I believe rescission is appropriate in this case. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. Your oral arguments were quite helpful as far as the matters of this particular case. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame.